Welcome to the New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore podcast, where twice a month we explore the world of New Hampshire that lies outside of the hard news. I'm your host, Wayne King, and I invite you to join us for an adventure that will take us on a journey together to explore those things that are unlikely to make the pages of your newspaper, the waves of your radio station, or the bits and bytes of your favorite news website. Yet for many of us, these stories will reveal what makes life here in the Granite State truly worth living. Together we'll uncover some secrets, speculate on a few rumors and legends, and we'll meet the people and a critter or two, both living and long departed, who weave together the colorful tapestry of New Hampshire's past, as well as some who are helping to build our future. We'll explore places known and unknown that you will want to add to your bucket list. We'll laugh together, gasp together, and maybe even shed a tear or two.
So I grew up in an unincorporated part of northern Delaware called Greenville, Delaware, near Hoops Reservoir. And that I got into birding when I was about 8. And by 10, I was a bird nerd, really. They didn't call it birding back then, they called it bird watching. And I didn't have any neighbors of my age. And so my buddies were beagles. And I would go out every morning birding with my beagles. Anyway, as we went through the 50s and 60s, all the areas where I used to walk in my neighborhood, or most of them anyway, were turned from not house lots, but housing developments. And the road I used to go into Wilmington went from 2 lanes to 6. And, so what was going on is Newcastle County, Delaware, was one of the fastest growing counties in the entire country back then. And my whole area that I was accustomed to and liked was really, really changed. And so when I got here, I said, I can't let that happen here.
That is the voice of Mead Cato, who for 33 years was the executive director of the Harris Center for Conservation in the Monadnock region, describing the situation in Delaware where he grew up that gave him the inspiration to make sure that that same thing did not happen here in New Hampshire. And Mead, who at the time that he was really beginning his professional career was hearing lots about cluster development, tipped that concept on its head and began to talk about cluster conservation and the opportunities for protecting the habitat of native species by purchasing and or protecting tracts of land that were near one another that when put together created large swaths of conservation land. And that's where he came up with the concept that he talks about in this interview of a super sanctuary. Here's my conversation with one of the great conservationists of our area and our time, Mead Cato. Well, I am speaking with the one and only Meade Cadeau, and I pronounced your name wrong.
Cadeau. Yeah, you did a little tiny bit. So it's my parents pronounced it Cadeau, and I've always said it rhymes with shadow. I'm also always grateful for the silent T any way I can get it. You know, so, but it's one other way my parents pronounced it. It was Cadeau rhymes with shadow.
Okay. And Meade was the director for 33 years, the executive director for 33 years of the Harris Center, which is one of the most extraordinary nature centers and conservation centers anywhere, as far as I'm concerned. But I may be a little prejudiced because I first met Meade actually even before he came to Harris, that was at the Audubon Center on Newfound Lake, the Paradise Point. It was I don't know what it's called now, the Paradise Point Audubon Center.
Yeah, Paradise Point Nature Center, still called that.
Yeah, and I was a counselor for kids at Camp Mowgli over on Newfound Lake. And Camp Mowgli had actually been the original source of the land that became the Paradise Point.
Well, that's something I didn't know.
Center. Yeah, it was owned by a fellow named Colonel Alcott Ferrer Elwell.
Oh, yeah, I remember the name.
Yeah, yeah, very, very.
So I can give you a little story about how I got to Paradise Point.
Oh, I'd love that.
Okay. So I'll try to shorten this up. In 1961, when I went off to college, my father was a Virginian. He wanted me to go to school in Virginia. I didn't want to go to UVA, so I went to Washington Lee. Washington Lee is a good school, but field ecology, it wasn't even in their lexicon. So all the biology courses I took were basically pre-med courses. And I was not enjoying it at all. And when I was a junior, I had to get my biology degree. I had to either take physics, and I'm horrible at math, or geology. So I said, okay, I'll take geology. So I took geology, and holy hell, they went outside. I couldn't believe it. They actually left the classroom and went out and looked at stuff. I said, well, maybe I'll be a geologist. So I finagled my way, started looking around for universities that would take me and pay my way to go to graduate school in geology with a biology background. And I found one, and it was the University of Kansas. So I got out there and I got hooked up with a fellow who was studying something called ostracodes, and I got interested in him because I got kind of bored with rocks. They didn't really move much. They didn't do anything. And he was looking at living ostracodes. And what reason he was doing that is because the oil industry liked to look at these little microfossils as a way of judging the age and environment of the rock when it was being formed. So I got into studying these ostracodes, and that was great. I got to go to Southern Indian Ocean and the Tasman Sea and Tierra del Fuego and a summer in Bermuda, blah, blah, blah. Had a great time collecting stuff. But when I got around to crunching the data back to the computer, I really didn't like that at all. And in 1971, I had a fellowship to use the Smithsonian Institution's electron microprobe analyzer to look at my little ostracodes try to figure out the shell chemistry. Well, I was there in the middle of the summer in DC because I was just a graduate student. I got the midnight shift on the machine. And I really got to the point where I said, I got to get out of here. I can't take it. I know, I'll go up and visit my aunt and uncle on Newfound Lake in Bristol. So I went out to visit them, and they took me over to this nature center, Paradise Point. And I found out that it wasn't the same naturalist there every year. I also found out that my aunt knew the executive director of Audubon, Tudor Richards, and I got introduced. So I wrote Tudor Richards a letter, and I said, I would put a pause on my geology graduate school studies if I could have a summer job at Paradise Point. And that's how I got there. I was a summer naturalist in 1972, and then again in 73. And in 73, I told Tudor, can't you get me a year-round job? I'd rather do this. So he got me a one-year-round job at Willard Pond. And that's how I got down here. And while I was at Willard Pond for that 1 year, I started teaching for Antioch. And that led one thing to another. And before I knew it, I was asked to be the first executive director of the Harris Center.
Now, that was in the very early years of Antioch, New England as well. I mean,
that's right. There were many years when I thought one or the other would fold in the beginning. Actually, there was quite a bit of synergy between the two. You know, even today, in my opinion, our very best staff people, especially the teacher naturalists, are people that have come from Antioch. In fact, I had some of them in my classes, you know, way before I retired from that.
Well, so I've interviewed the remarkable Tom Wessels a number of times.
Oh, I don't blame you.
For this podcast.
I don't blame you. He lived in New Hampshire, not too far from here for a while, but now he's in Maine.
Right, right. Yeah. Most recently, we had this very long philosophical discussion about how we get people singing the same song again instead of fighting with one another. But we started off with just sort of forest forensics and all that. You have had a remarkable life doing so much in the area of conservation and land protection, and to have started off with somebody like Tudor Richards, who is really a New Hampshire icon, it must have been pretty amazing.
It was. You know, Tudor was a character. A lot of these icons are characters too, and he was definitely a
character. Oh yeah.
I had fun with Tudor. I remember that one trip I did with him up to his favorite place, Cherry Pond, up in northern New Hampshire. But anyway, yeah, I enjoyed it. But I also was glad to not be dependent on part-time jobs, which is what the Audubon gigs were. So it was good that I was able to get going at the Harris Center.
So tell us a little more about your backstory. Where did you grow up? So
I grew up in an unincorporated part of northern Delaware called Greenville, Delaware, near Hoops Reservoir. And, I was subject to busing, you know, not because of racial problems, but because my schools were a long way away. So I had long rural bus trips. But one of the things that made me do what I've done is that, well, first of all, let me say that I got into birding when I was about 8. And by 10, I was a bird nerd, really. They didn't call it birding back then. They called it bird watching. And I didn't have any neighbors of my age. And so my buddies were beagles. And I would go out every morning birding with my beagles. Anyway, as we went through the 50s and 60s, all the areas where I used to walk in my neighborhood, or most of them anyway, were turned from not house lots, but housing developments. And the road I used to go into Wilmington went from 2 lanes to 6. And, so what was going on is Newcastle County, Delaware, was one of the fastest growing counties in the entire country back then. And my whole area that I was accustomed to and liked was really, really changed. And so when I got here, I said, I can't let that happen here.
Uh-huh. So that solidified your determination to...
Yeah, it didn't help to watch my grandparents' Holstein dairy farm go from cows to condos either. That was in Westchester, Pennsylvania, not far away.
So you navigated your way through college, and then your brief time at the Paradise Point Nature Center, and then you were down in the area where the Harris Center was born. Tell us a little bit about the origins there.
Well, the Harris Center started off as a conservation education center, and that's the brainchild of Eleanor Briggs. She's the founder. So the Harris Center was the summer house for Eleanor's grandparents. And when she had an experience similar to mine, she grew up on Long Island, about halfway out, and would come up to spend the summer with her grandparents up here. And that was her summer place. And meanwhile, her part of Long Island got paved over just like Newcastle County, Delaware did. So that made an impression on her. So I think we both had similar mindsets about not wanting that to happen here in the Monadnock region. But when we started, we were a conservation education center. We weren't a land trust. And people back then were saying, oh yeah, there's development, it's coming, you know. But we got these mountains over here. They're never going to come out. They're never going to get this far. And I was pretty sure that it could get that far. And so I started thinking about it and watching what was going on. See if I can find this clipping here.
Now, at this point, we talked about a series of images that Meade had available to him, one of which was an early 80s story from the New York Times that... showed the likely development of the entire corridor from Boston down to Washington, D.C., and then some other images of development that was occurring closer to home in the Route 101 corridor. And I will put those images on the show notes, but it was clear that this had an impact on Meade's concern over the development that was taking place in New Hampshire.
In 1982, I was driving down 1A, and I was driving past the last farm in Nashua. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
You see this Tamposi sign there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sam Tamposi, one of the biggest developers. And I said, uh-oh, here it comes. I better be ready to tell a story. So I stopped and I took a picture.
Oh.
And then I came back 5 years later and stood at the same place. And so I use these two pictures as part of my way of telling people, you know, it can come here.
Right.
We don't make sure that it doesn't.
So for people who are listening to this, that it went from a farm.
Multiple layers of development. When I took that picture in 1985, it wasn't even finished. It was another layer of development put on top of that.
Right. And what you showed me was a gas station. It looked like a gas station.
Well, there's a bank there, and oh, they painted it red to make it look like a barn. That wasn't that nice of them.
Mead also produced a article from the Keene Sentinel that caught his attention and was indicative of the changes sweeping through the area.
Merrimack dump hunting an issue. Local hunters and the police chief are involved in a disagreement over hunting near the town dump. Hunters say it is one of the few places left in town where they have a good chance of bagging game. You want to have a town where your best chance of bagging game is your dump?
Right.
So that's another illustrative photo that I use to say, hey, and the Harris Center's way of doing things is always to show other people how to do things. So my whole way of going about building the super sanctuary was the idea of working with neighbors, trying to get neighborhoods interested in working together and to protect land. And my big interest going way back to birding when I was a kid was in wildlife. And I knew that if we were going to keep wildlife on the kind of wildlife I was interested in, like bears and bobcats and back then moose and other critters on our landscape, we needed to protect not just a parcel of land here and a parcel there, but clusters of parcels. So I used the term clustered open space. I started using that back in 1984 when I gave a talk at the Amos Fortune Lecture Series. And I was on the planning board in Hancock for about 20 years. And back during the development boom years, you remember these, one of the big buzzwords was, let's do cluster development. And there was a lot of resistance to that, and it didn't really accomplish all that much. So I said, well, why don't we do the Alice through the Looking Grass thing? Let's cluster the open space instead. And by clustering the open space, you can do a lot more than you can by just protecting a parcel here or a parcel there. You know, on our website, it says all this stuff. But you can create blocks of habitat that are big enough for far-ranging species, like, as I mentioned, like bobcat and black bear. And that also allows you to provide forest interior. Some songbirds, believe it or not, actually, even though they're tiny, they require big areas in order to maintain a population. One example I used is the black-throated blue warbler. And studies have shown that in order to have a population of those, you got to have more than 2,000 acres of forest interior. Having a big block like that, or a cluster of open space, also enables you to carry out both wildlife management and forestry at the same time. And it offers the opportunity for the backcountry recreation kind of thing, like I was talking about, hunting, trekking, camping, that sort of thing. And by working with neighborhoods, I also did a lot of work in the super sanctuary along what are called scenic roads. You know what the Scenic Roads Act is. Mm-hmm. And those are roads that are, you know, they're basically social roads that were built to connect farmers with the village, not to transport goods. And we have several scenic roads that are part of the super sanctuary that we worked on protecting land, and those that can be enjoyed by everybody. Scenic driving, bicycling. And you can also, by clustering the open space, you can protect water resources much better. You know, watersheds.
Right.
Lakeshores, wellheads. And so there are lots of good reasons for clustering your open space. In other words, focusing on the next parcel you're going to protect being next to the one you've already protected, and start building these clusters. And as it turns out today, there's another reason why that's important, because it strengthens the forest's ability to be resilient in the face of climate change and allows it to perform better ecological functions like carbon storage and sequestration. So what was true back then is even truer now. It's really a good thing to do.
Right.
So we started with 7 acres, but there was one you like stories. There was one particular story that got me going. We have a lake, and I'll show you a picture of it, called Spoonwood Pond. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's over 150 acres, and it's even back then it was unique because it has absolutely no development on it.
And what town is that in, Mead?
It's in two towns. It's in, well, actually, Spoonwood is all in Nelson. You get to Spoonwood across Newbanusett. And Newbanusett is in Nelson and Hancock. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Some of the shoreline of Spoonwood is actually also in Nelson. But those two towns are right together. And I don't know if whether you remember Jan McClure or not, but Jan, back in the early 80s, was working for the Forest Society. I think she worked for PNC after that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she suggested that we have a jointly sponsored Harris Center and Forest Society canoe trip to Spoonwood in the early fall of 1982. And I said, well, that sounds like a good idea. So both of our organizations advertised it. And we thought, well, I hope we get a couple dozen, people to come. Wouldn't that be nice? And on the day of the event, we got there and there were 70 people there.
Wow.
Their canoes. Back then, there were no kayaks. So we had kind of a flotilla going across Spoonwood. And then, as we all had a great time, it was a beautiful day, picnic lunch, all that. And as we came back into the shoreline on our way back, somebody from Landvest, I don't know who he's to this day, put up real estate for sale signs facing out as canoeists coming back to the shoreline. A couple of brothers had inherited some land, and one of them wanted to sell his half, and he had forced a subdivision. So it was Landvest was trying to get us interested in buying this 22 acres, and they had this little flyer. Oh, it's so close to Boston. It's so all these things that scared the bejesus out of me and everybody else. So that's what got me in my first fundraising campaign. Ash Hallett at the Forest Society helped me out. And, I had no idea how this was going to go. But I did know Newt Tolman. I don't know if you know Newt, ever heard of him. He's a famous author in the neck of the woods, kind of a real character. And he had the biggest piece of land on Spoonwood, and it was close to 400 acres. And he had one house high up on Osgood Hill. And I used to go up there and talk to him about land conservation and try to get him interested. And he would string me along. He would never commit to anything. But one time he showed me his deed to his land on Spoonwood. And he had gotten it from the son of Frederick Law Olmsted in the 1950s.
Wow.
And I saw that in the deed, there was a clause inserted saying that if every landowner around Spoonwood Pond agrees, then there will be no development within 300 feet of the shore of Spoonwood. So I said, aha. And so when we started this campaign to raise the money to buy these 22 acres, I went to the two other landowners on Spoonwood, or maybe it was three. One of them was TNC. One of them was Keene State, which had a deed-restricted piece given to them by the Nature Conservancy. And then the other brother, And I went to them and I got them to sign this covenant so that when I went around, when we went fundraising, we could say, not only are we going to buy the 22 acres, but if we get the 22 acres, we're going to protect the entire shoreline all the way around or 300 feet back. So I went really well. And we did the deed. And then a couple of years later, Newt, with his wife dead, his wife was his guardrails. You know, he was a character. And he decided to sell half interest in all his land on Osgood Mountain and Spoonwood Pond to Sir Sosimo Timber Company in Brattleboro. And that created quite a controversy. Articles were written about it. Ernie Hebert wrote an article about it for the Boston Globe, talking about the Baron of Greengate. Anyway, to try to make a long story sort of short, his son and his nephew and company went to court and got the deal thrown out because they said Tamposi had taken, Sir Sosimo had taken advantage of an elderly man who wanted to. Newt's plan was to take the money and buy a Rolls Royce, drive it to the top of the hill and sit in it and watch TV, which he did. But the court reversed the sale and there was a settlement. So Newt got the land back, but Newt had to go into a nursing home at that point. And so the son and nephew and spouses, Karen Tolman, Karen and Barry and Wren, they had to sell the property. So we said, well, what are we going to do about that? You know, that's the property was being sold for $495,000, virtually $500,000. And that was way, way beyond the means of the Harris Center back then. But then we had an anonymous friend that came to us and said, well, we would like you to have that. Here's a check for $495,000.
Wow.
So that's how part of that was the way that the Harris Center got into the land trust business in kind of a quirky, splashy way. And then in 1985, that same year, I came up with this idea of let's connect the land around Osgood and Spoonwood with the land over at Willard Pond where I had been and the land that Eleanor Briggs put under conservation easement with the Forest Society in 1985. So here's some clusters of open space. Let's work on protecting land in between those places. And let's build a super sanctuary. So that's how we got started. And, you know, there are many, many stories I could tell, but the bottom line is today the super sanctuary is, you know, 40,000 acres. Whoa. And the Harris Center has interest in about 25,000 of those acres. So it's grew way beyond my wildest dreams.
That's extraordinary. Now, how was it that Eleanor Briggs is a, it's a much beloved name in that part of the state and actually within the conservation.
Actually, she might be a good interview for you. I should have mentioned her. Because she's got a pretty interesting story about the 2,000 acres of the land that she bought and put under easement with the Forest Society. She didn't buy it, rather. She inherited that land from her father, but she inherited the land in trust. So there were a bunch of Boston trustees that had the ultimate decision as to what was going to happen with that land, which included a couple of mountains and a mile of shore frontage on New Anus and three remote ponds. It's called the Briggs Preserve now. But you know how trustees in Boston are about assets like that. they were in charge of, they're supposed to make money for their client, so for the trustee. So she had a long, long struggle with the trustees to convince them to allow her to encumber all that land in the conservation easement. But you should really hear that story from her rather than me.
So how was it that you came into the same orbit with her to begin with?
Well, when Eleanor started the Harris Center in 1970, and it was a, you know, it was just a, I think the, I don't know how much money there was, but there was a board and a one employee and a volunteer executive director named Cecil Lyon. And Cecil Lyon was a retired diplomat. He was ambassador of Paris and Chile. I don't remember all his things. Great guy. But he didn't know the first thing about running a conservation education center. And so when he started hearing about me, doing the work I was doing, teaching at Antioch and doing this stuff at Willard Pond and starting a school program for elementary and middle school kids, on and on, he decided that I should be the one doing the work. And he convinced Eleanor, I guess, that they should have an executive director that knew what they were doing. And so Cecil didn't go on a very big job search. He just went over and grabbed me. So I went from being the 1 year naturalist director at Willard Pond to the first executive director of the Harris Center, and that was in 1975.
Now, Mead, was it originally called the Harris Center? Or
no.
Tell us this.
Originally called it, there's a good story there too. Maybe you read it in somewhere, but it was originally called the Harris Foundation. And she named the Harris Foundation after her cat. She had this cat named Harris, which was a stray from a brownstone in Manhattan. And she used to go walking with a stray cat when she was up here. And so when she was only in her 30s then, she didn't want to name it after herself. She wouldn't have a foundation named after herself. So she named it after the Harris, the cat. One of the things that Cecil was able to do while he was in his capacity as director of the Harris Center is ask Margaret Mead to come and talk to the Harris Center.
Wow.
And the hook was his daughter, Margaret Mead's daughter, lived in Hancock. She's deceased now, but actually ended up being in protecting her land there. But anyway, so Cecil figured he could talk her into, Margaret Mead, into coming. And so Margaret Mead came, and he had a reception for her before her talk at his house. And Eleanor was there, and I was there. And Margaret Mead says something like, to the extent, well, I see you're a foundation. You're a foundation. Foundations give away money, so I'm going to have to charge you. And Eleanor's heart sank, and you know, Cecil went pale in the face because we knew that we had nowhere near the money to pay her what her stipend for something like that would be. So Cecil mumbled something about, well, you say your daughter lives here. You said you were going to come anyway. Blah, 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 and you weren't going to charge us anything. And she said, oh, I did? Okay, then I won't. But the first thing I did in my, I think the first or second board meeting that I attended as executive director of the Harris Center, Harris Foundation, I said, hey, we got to change the name. We don't go out and ask people for money if our name is the Harris Foundation. So at that first or second board meeting, we talked about what names to use. And, you know, back then, environmental was really hot, you know, but environmental was also, the word was very overused at the time. I remember some cleaner being labeled, cleans environmental services. Well, anyway, so I suggested that we name it the Harris Center for Conservation Education instead of environmental education. And everybody liked that idea, and we've been that ever since. Although it took a couple of, at least a generation and a half before the old guard stopped calling us the Harris Foundation.
Well, I would, I'd at some point love to interview Eleanor. It would be kind of a happy reunion for me anyway.
I recommend it. She used to travel quite a bit. She spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia. She's kind of a national hero of sorts in Cambodia. But you can probably, she's around. She was here a couple of weeks ago, so I bet you can catch her.
Okay.
She's still a sharp lady.
Excellent. So, okay, so tell us more about establishing this super center.
Super sanctuary.
Super sanctuary.
Well, just, you know, in the beginning, we got some land gifts, and as time went by and land became more valuable, then we started getting conservation easement gifts. And then as time went by, things got more and more expensive. In recent years, we've been actually buying land. And we've been able to do that because the Monadnock region's got a very strong land ethic to begin with. And we have, you know, people that are our supporters that have bought into what we're trying to do. And some people have been very, very generous in funding us to make some pretty good land acquisition projects. So, you know, I can say to everybody, I didn't do all this. I had a lot of help. And I haven't been at the Harris Center for 10 years, and it's continued to build on the super sanctuary. When I retired, it was about 30,000. Now it's about 40,000. So it's still growing. People just like the idea.
Well, that's the foundation that you established, and that's something that of which you can be exceedingly proud. And I think we in New Hampshire and everywhere owe you a great debt of gratitude for not only what you've done with the super sanctuary, but with your example in general.
Well, let me tell you another bit about the super sanctuary that's really important, especially in the beginning. First of all, we have a boundary around the super sanctuary now. I can tell you that story. But we were looking to connect with those who collected protected land, and that included other organizations. It wasn't just the Harris Center. I mean, the Harris Center helped the Audubon Society make the Willard Pond Sanctuary bigger, but it's the Audubon Sanctuary. And we've worked with the Forest Society and other projects. We worked with TNC on projects. We worked with the Monadnock Conservancy on projects. So building the super sanctuary, it's always been about not who protects what, but what gets protected. So the super sanctuary, in part, has been successful because it's not just the Harris Center.
Uh-huh. Because so many others were involved in the process.
Yeah, I mean, the best example of that, was one of the last big ones which I was involved with, which was Robb Reservoir. I don't know how much time you want to spend on one topic because it's a long one. I'll try to make it short. Let's see. You know what? I mentioned to you when we were first getting together that under the Harris Center website, if you go to 50 years, you can find Meade's Tall Tales.
Right.
Well, Robb Reservoir comprises three of Meade's Tall Tales. So it's a long story. But let me just say that I was first introduced to Rob Reznor by John Coolidge in 1974. He took me canoeing, he took me fishing on Rob Reznor to catch hornpout, brown bullheads. And when he was there, he was a very infamous guy himself, famous guy himself. And he was very well known for his wildlife knowledge. And he told me, he said, "You know, Rob Reznor and the part of the property that comprises the headwaters of the North Branch of the Kentucky River right below it are the best otter habitat anywhere around." And that stuck with me because I know the otter is like the black bear. The black bear is an umbrella species for land-based critters, otter for the wetland critters. So that stuck with me. And I have kept my eye on Rob Reznor for years. And it was owned by a guy named Thurston Williams. And in 1952, he leased the reservoir to New Hampshire Fish and Game for 30 years. He didn't sell it, he just leased it. And they went and put a Pittman Robinson waterfowl enhancement dam on Rob Reznor to make it this 150-acre pond that it turned out to be. And come 30 years later, 1982, Fish and Game says, "Will you renew the lease?" "Heck no, I'm going to develop this property." So his idea of what to do with it was totally different from mine. And so from the 80s right through to when, so after he died, there were various ploys to try to get the land protected. And you can read the three different chapters in the These Tall Tales, but in the end, with the support of all other organizations, the Forest Society, TNC, and Audubon, all saying the Harris Center should be the owner of the land, we were able to work with the Trust for Public Land. I don't know if you're familiar with that organization.
Yes.
But, they're essentially a funder rather than a holder of anything.
Right.
So they helped us. They helped obtain a $3 million Forest Legacy Grant and $100,000 NACA grant and a Moose Plate grant. And then we went out and raised several hundred thousand dollars, I don't remember the exact figure, privately. And we were able in 2007 to get protection of Rob Reznor. It's our biggest reservation now. It's like more than 1750 acres. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example, a big one. The story of how I got to draw a line, had to draw a line around the super sanctuaries, took place in around, 2003 maybe, 2002, I don't know, somewhere in there. Anyway, I'm not going to tell that story. Forget it. You got to read that one. Ask me another question.
So you've been a birder all your life. Has that been a major portion of creating this super sanctuary?
It wasn't a driver. I really got interested in when I got here from the landed in the Monadnock region. Let me tell you one thing that happened to me when I was at Paradise Point visiting my aunt and uncle. Their farm there up on Hemp Hill overlooking Newfound Lake. So this would have been around 1971. So I was walking around the edge of the woods. The woods now belongs to the Forest Society. It was given to them. And I sat down under this tree at the edge of the woods and I thought to myself, well, I wonder what it was like here 100 years ago when it was all this all the wildlife would have been here. And I heard this noise, and I looked up, and there was a funny animal looking down at me, a strange animal, something I'd never seen before. So I ran back to the nature center and went through all the my mammal field guide, and I realized it was a fisher.
Uh-huh.
I said, holy cow, this is really neat. I want to live here. Well, anyway, through that, just as a beginning, and then through doing many outings with John Coolish, who's a reformed trapper and a deer hunting guide who worked for us as our staff, first staff person. And then for years teaching field mammalogy for Antioch, I got really interested in the needs of mammals. I really based that. That was really the driver in terms of my wildlife thinking when it comes to the super sanctuary. Birds can fly. They don't necessarily need parcels to be right next to each other.
Right.
But, you know, a black bear is a good example of any of the large carnivores also. So that was more of a driver, but I kept my interest in birds my whole life. And so one of the things I'm doing now is volunteering as a board member for the International Conservation Fund of Canada. And that's an organization who does a lot of land protection work in the tropics, tropical forests, and where Canadian birds go to spend the winter.
Uh-huh. Oh.
So the original thinking was, well, if we're going to protect birds in Canada, we got to protect birds where they go in the winter.
Right.
So this International Conservation Fund of Canada has become a pretty big deal. If you go on their website, you'll see what they've done and what they're doing. Anyway, in the early 80s, I had a guy named Scott Hecker take my wildlife management and forest and wildlife management class. And all of a sudden, here he is back living in Temple as the bird expert for bird programs for the International Conservation Fund of Canada. And he asked me to join the board. So I've been extending my birding interests lately. I went to Belize this year, going to Costa Rica in the fall, hopefully going to Ecuador next year. So I'm birding again.
Yeah, that's exciting. Well, you know, in those years when we knew each other back on Newfound Lake, there were no bald eagles left.
Right.
Now we have several nesting pairs around the lake.
Right. Right. I know. That's really a great story of what people can do if they want to. Actually, one of the very early nesting sites in the Monadnock region or anywhere in the state, really out south of Umbagog, was on Nubanusa, way back in the, I think it was the early 90s, on land that Eleanor Briggs owned. And she's actually put an easement on that land since then.
Wow. Well, Mead Caddow, you have been just an extraordinary resource for the state of New Hampshire. And I just want to say thank you for all that you have done over the years and for all that you will continue to do.
Well, thank you. I enjoy this. I could do one more story about land conservation, if you're interested. It might be interesting to you. And it happened. A lot of things happen when you don't expect them. So in 2003, I was in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I was doing a field course for the Antioch graduate students. And I got a phone call at midnight. My students were out playing Frisbee, from a guy who was an easement donor in Nelson. And he says, Mr. Caddo, a developer has bought this land on Lead Mine Road, Apple Hill. You ever heard of the Apple Hill team of music people?
Yeah.
Anyway, he's gonna put in a 16 lot development. It's gonna really spoil Apple Hill, and it's gonna be horrible for the town. What are you gonna do? I said, I'm in Alaska. But when I got back, I got together with some friends of the Harris Center and the Nelson Conservation Commission folks, and we came up with a plan where we would try to buy a conservation easement from this guy. And so what we did was we got an appraisal for an idea and an attorney. And the idea was, okay, we can't afford to buy this developer out, but maybe we can talk him into a limited development and protecting most of the land. And we came up with the appraiser came up with a figure about what that would be worth on the market. So we approached the guy and he agreed. So we were able to get 172 acres of the parcel protected, including a ridge and a brook and watershed in between, and limit the old building to just four houses along the road. So that was one example of how it wasn't just the Harris Center, it was the Harris Center working with the Conservation Commission to accomplish a really important addition to the super sanctuary.
So, I mean, what it really says is that the work that you have done over the years with support of people like Eleanor Briggs has created a foundation, if you will, not a I hesitate to use that word because somebody's going to be asking you for money. but has created the seeds of a long-term gift.
Right.
The entire.
Okay. You reminded me of one other story. One more story I really want to tell because it involves a gift. In the year 2000, a woman who had sent her kids to our camp, and her kids had loved the camp and ended up marrying another person from that they met in camp and getting married at the Harris Center. Anyway, fond of the Harris Center, but she was a divorced person that had moved to Boston. She needed to sell her land, but she wanted to give the Harris Center a chance to be the first buyer, first chance to buy. So it was like 69 acres. And we had some friends of the Super Sanctuary who were willing to help. But then what I did was I went to property tax map and I looked to see what other land was near this land. And I saw that there was a 720 acre piece that was in the Sidney Williams Trust. So I went to find out who was the beneficiary of the trust. And it turned out to be the aunt of this woman that was trying to sell her property. And so, this aunt was in a retirement home, without any financial obligations, so to speak. She's very well taken care of. So I had this idea that maybe she would be willing to donate that land to help us to leverage the money to buy the 69 acres.
Uh-huh.
And so with the help of her son, Sandy, who later became a Harris Center trustee and treasurer of the Harris Center, that's what happened. She actually, after two visits with her, she actually agreed to give us 720 acres to help us buy 69 acres. And so when we went out to raise the money, it was such a good pitch that we got more money than we needed. And we bought another 126 acres with that. So we ended up with this huge cluster of almost 1,000 acres by buying 69 acres. And I'll send you a picture. I have a picture of it. I'll send you. So we were able to connect Eleanor's land with this land all the way over to Harrisville Pond, this huge new protected block of land, by buying 69 acres. Wow. And with really, really generous people.
The people of that area have always had a reputation as being close to the land.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's not without cause. They are both a generous and a group of folks that just love the land.
That's right. So that's why I always say it's not just me. It's the Monadnock region, the people that live here and believe in the idea.
Well, what do you have any last words about what it's been like living in the Monadnock region?
I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I do have to say that, you know, like everybody else, we have this big shadow hanging over us all now about what to do about the climate. And I feel somewhat comfortable in that the super sanctuary is actually, in a small way, helping to build some resilient forest. But we, as a humanity, has got a big job ahead.
Yes.
I think about that every day.
Yeah. It looms large in our future.
Very large.
Yep. Well, thank you very much, Mead. I hope we'll have an opportunity to talk again.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, Wayne.
Okay. You take care.
Take care.
My thanks to Mead Cato for taking the time to speak with us today and for all that he has done to make life worth living in the Monadnock region. If you had the chance to listen to our earlier podcast with Tom Wessels, you'll understand how this is evidence of what Tom was saying when he talked about the importance of turning back to our communities in the face of the challenges that are ahead of us now. And if you haven't heard it, I encourage you to go back and listen to that podcast as well. Thanks for joining us on New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore. This podcast will also be featured on our sister podcast, The Radical Centrist, to expand the universe of people that are able to listen to it. The show notes for this podcast can be found at nhsecrets.blogspot.com, where you can make a contribution, where you can pick up some merch, where you can head on over to the art website, and if you find something that you can't possibly live without, make a purchase, and we will contribute 50% of the value of that purchase to the nonprofit of your choosing. Thank you so much for joining us on New Hampshire Secrets, Legends, and Lore, and we'll see you on the next episode very soon.